I swore last week that I would be on time this week. I decided to come a different route, and for some reason, I ran into the same amount of stoplights. So, you know, I didn't want to violate too many of man's laws coming over here, so I apologize for the tardiness. But welcome to the second week of this thing, and glad you're here. Glad to see some new faces and some of the old faces, and hopefully, God willing, there'll be something edifying in this big mix of stuff. But first of all, I want to double check. Can you guys hear me fine here? All right. Okay. Back in 2012, Glenn Beck decided it was time to go on a jihad against social justice in the church. On his March 2nd radio program, Beck laid out his argument. And this is Beck speaking, Glenn Beck. "I beg you, look for the words social justice or economic justice on your church website. If you find it, run as fast as you can. Social justice and economic justice, they are code words. Now, am I advising people to leave their church? Yes! If I'm going to Jeremiah Wright's church, yes, leave your church. Social justice and economic justice, they are code words. If you have a priest that is pushing social justice, go find another parish. Go alert your bishop and tell them, excuse me, are you down with this whole social justice thing? I don't care what the church is. If it's my church, I'm alerting church authorities. Excuse me, what's this social justice thing? And if they say, yeah, we're all in that social justice thing, I'm in the wrong place." Thus spoke Glenn Beck. Beck repeated the warning on his then top-rated Fox News program, adding that the quest for social justice on the part of Christians led inexorably to national socialism, i.e. Nazism, and totalitarian communism of Stalin and Mao. Calling any concern with social justice by a Christian a perversion of the gospel, Beck insisted that Jesus came to model a ministry of compassion and healing based on individual acts of mercy, not state intervention or any Christian collective action that in the end undermines the primacy of capitalism. It was a remarkable piece of gospel interpretation. Somehow, Glenn Beck looked at the words and acts of Jesus in the Gospels and found a Messiah who would have hated the Affordable Care Act and the social safety net because it deprived his followers of the opportunity to heal the sick and feed the hungry individually. I know that Beck is a Mormon convert, so there's bound to be an odd hermeneutic at work when he looks at the life and ministry of Jesus. Still, I would wager that most Mormons don't look at Jesus and see Ayn Rand or Paul Rand, for that matter. Very few Christians who aren't biblically illiterate see Jesus as a libertarian who was willing to accept a certain amount of poverty, suffering, and injustice to keep the Roman economy humming along. Most people know his ministry was not about rewarding rugged individualism or rugged economic and spiritual individualism. What does one do with verses from Amos like, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream," or Micah, "This is what the Lord requires of you, to do what is right, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. These two verses that literally echo the sentiment of the entire Bible when it comes to the question of taking action to right wrongs. God tells his people over and over that he's offended by their burnt offerings and religious festivals if they've left fundamental issues of justice and mercy in their communities unattended. What was merely stated loudly in the Old Testament gets a bullhorn in the New Testament by Jesus' words and examples. When Jesus healed physically and spiritually broken people on the Sabbath, he was criticized by religious authorities. The Sabbath was for resting, they insisted, not for doing good. The Pharisees were Glenn Beck, 2,000 years before the broadcaster arrived on the scene. Yet, Beck has a tremendous following among people who consider themselves Bible-believing Christians. They may not buy into every one of his wacky conspiracy theories, but there is widespread suspicion in the church that too much social justice turns Jesus into the second coming of Karl Marx, and they're not having it. So many well-meaning Christians settle for a bizarro world Jesus that mutters such heretical nonsense as, God helps those who help themselves, and blessed are the one percenters, for they have earned the right to the spoils of half the planet's population by 2016. In a way, it would make more sense for me to read Martin Luther King's magnificent letter from a Birmingham jail in its entirety to you rather than cast about vainly making the same point in my own words, but I won't do that. I'm sure most of you are already familiar with or have heard excerpts from it. In that April 16th, 1963 letter, MLK responded to criticism leveled his way by the white religious leaders of Birmingham that he was unnecessarily provoking the social and political order of that town, and that black people would be much better off if they allowed the city fathers to take their time bringing about an orderly transition to integration. Protests antagonized politicians and the police, leading to violence. Martin Luther King's arrest was entirely his own fault, in their view. His response to these preachers was superb. This is a brief excerpt. And this is King speaking, or writing, from jail. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride towards freedom is not the white citizens' counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. Martin Luther King spent the bulk of the letter, written in longhand during his time in jail, invoking the example of the Old Testament prophets and Christian and non-Christian thinkers through the ages.
I'm sorry. Let me cut this. Oh, it's some telemarketer, I'm sure. Unbelievable.
But he kept circling back to Jesus' example for his followers, for a model of radical disobedience in the face of injustice. This is King speaking again. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which spitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus Christ. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. And John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be, King wrote. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill, three men were crucified. We must never forget that all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below their environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. So how did social justice become a four-letter word in vast swaths of the church? How did siding with the oppressed, a fundamental aspect of Jesus' mission, get turned on its head? Where is their support in any of the 66 books of the Bible for a prophetic tradition that celebrates the accumulation of wealth and power at the expense of the poor? What prophet in the Old Testament stood on the side of the wealthy, railing against the poor and the oppressed about their rotten life choices, while admonishing them for insisting on justice from their rulers? With the exception of one very short tree-climbing money manager who immediately gave up half his fortune to follow Jesus, his disciples were not corporate raiders, oligarchs, or scions of great wealth. They were low on the economic totem pole. They weren't respectable citizens of the realm. The disciples were such badasses, they were even guilty of harboring a despicable IRS agent in their little cabal. If anything, Jesus proved himself to be a man without standards when it came to selecting his posse. They were all men of ill repute as far as the religious authorities were concerned. It was a deadly combination all around, low morals and even worse credit. So last week, I was delighted to find out that Molly Rush, the co-founder of the Thomas Merton Center in the Garfield section of Pittsburgh, is an occasional worshiper here at Westminster Presbyterian. Molly, as most of you know, would have fit in perfectly with those first century followers of Jesus because she takes social justice seriously enough to go to prison for it. On September 9th, 1980, Molly and seven other peace activists, who have been dubbed the Plowshares Eight, walked into a building owned by General Electric across the state in King of Prussia. They didn't use bolt cutters or subterfuge to gain entry to the facility. They simply walked past inattentive guards and entered a room that was supposed to be off limits to unauthorized civilians. It was a room where nuclear warheads were assembled. Now remember, this was 1980, and the Cold War was still raging. Jimmy Carter was still president, and Reagan's election was weeks away. The Plowshares Eight didn't care about exhibiting pragmatism when they took out their hammers and began pounding the warheads. And they severely dented two of them. And it goes without saying that they knew that the warheads weren't armed. But it's a point that bears repeating and retelling the story. They didn't think they were about to blow up the world or anything. Just in case the action of pounding symbolic swords into plowshares was too subtle a reference for the folks at GE, Molly and her colleagues poured plastic bottles filled with their own blood over the paperwork scattered over the space and all over their dented handiwork, the nuclear warhead. Molly's cohorts that fateful day included Father Philip Berrigan, Father Daniel Berrigan, Sister Anne Montgomery, Father Carl Cabot, Elmer Moss, Dean Hammer, and John Shuthard. They were arrested and taken into custody by security as they kneeled and prayed. Their example was followed over the years by many others who felt the specter of nuclear annihilation in the 1980s necessitated dramatic, nonviolent action on their part as an example of their Christian witness. Still, their example put them at odds with most of their fellow Americans and fellow American Christians who were offended by their disobedience to the law. Some things just never change. Now, those of you who know Molly know that she isn't some scary, bug-eyed lunatic. She's a woman of conscience, a doting grandmother, a peace activist, and a devout Christian who loves music and liturgy. It was her convictions as a Christian that led her to join the Plowshares Eight in an act of civil disobedience that could have led to decades in prison instead of weeks and months. As the threat of nuclear weapon proliferation receded, Molly and the folks at the Thomas Merton Center turned to other pressing issues. She and her colleagues in Pittsburgh were in the forefront of protests against the Iraq War long before it started. They lobbied for single payer as part of the healthcare overhaul President Obama pursued in his first term. These days, the Thomas Merton Center protests against police brutality, for Palestinian rights, and pretty much every other issue that respectable churches scrupulously avoid. That's the pattern. Only a few Christians at a time are willing to be prophetic. In the early 1980s, I came across a book called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, Moving from Affluence to Generosity by Ronald Sider. It is a fairly balanced book about Christian economics that critiques both the hard-heartedness of conservatives who blame poverty on bad choices made by individuals, and liberals who insist utopia is attained by enlightened management and a more generous tax policy. Ron Sider didn't allow Christians to hide behind whatever their interpretation of proper theology was, if it meant ignoring the plight of the poor and the dispossessed. Sider linked a robust faith to practical expressions of that faith in communities of suffering and exploited people. It was a book that made you squirm because It reminded one of the discomforting reality of following a Savior who doesn't respect your overweening desire to remain comfortable. Because I was fairly new to the faith, I was naive enough to believe that Ron Sider's points were beyond debate and that it was merely a question of what form that service would take. That's why I was genuinely amazed to see a backlash against Sider's book in the conservative churches I attended at the time. One book called Productive Christians in an Age of Guilt Manipulation, A Biblical Response to Ron Sider by David Chilton, became quite popular in Calvinist, Reformed, and Presbyterian circles. I was Orthodox Presbyterian at the time. It was written by a proponent of the Christian Reconstructionist movement, a group of fiery neo-Calvinist radicals, mostly out of Texas and California, who argued that the Old Testament laws were still normative for all societies, including secular governments. They argued, these are the Christian Reconstructionists, the theonomists, they argued that Christians were obliged to take power over the world at the first opportunity, starting with America. Chilton's book was a full-throated defense of inequities in wealth and power. Chilton was in full alignment with the values of the administration, but didn't think it went far enough in extolling laissez-faire economics as the only biblical response to questions of wealth and poverty. It was sheer craziness, bitterness, and ad hominem arguments thrown at Sider and the liberals the book caricatures as enemies of Christ, socialist dupes, and fuzzy-headed antinomians. The book was dedicated to and championed by televangelist Pat Robertson, so now you have a better idea where it was coming from. And of course, it resonated like crazy where Christians who were tired of feeling bad about not taking Jesus seriously enough to follow him down to the soup kitchens of the inner cities. It was during this period that I got my first inclination that my fellow Christians were not infallible in their opinions and that an uncomfortably high number of them rank far below most non-Christians in terms of ethics, intolerance for hypocrisy, and the exercise of a social conscience. In fact, it was during this period that I learned that some Christians wholeheartedly believed that social justice with an emphasis on righting wrongs and challenging the status quo was an anti-Christian orientation. In America, Protestantism picked up on this strain of radical amnesia about the gospel's true meaning. The New World presented new opportunities and new ways to assess one's place in the scheme of things, especially those fleeing political persecution and poverty in old Europe. In America, one could be born again on the right side of the fickle power dynamic that made one a loser in Europe. After all, there were always several strata of less well-off whites, African Americans, and Native Americans bringing up the rear in America. One didn't have to be rich as long as he or she was fortunate enough to not be black or Indian or an impoverished white person or a woman. It didn't take long for wealth and poverty to be viewed as evidence of both God's blessing and God's disfavor. Churches and individuals aligned with God's will saw blessings and their fortunes increase in America. Those who found themselves impoverished or beset by misfortune were victims of their unbelief and rebellious attitude. They didn't work hard enough and looked to the state or some other entity rather than the sweat of their brow to save them. God helps those who help themselves, and Horatio Alger is his messenger. And while few will openly admit that this is an apt description of their worldview,
There is no doubt that it still exerts a powerful influence on contemporary Christian thought. It is particularly prevalent in the nonsensical pronouncements of presidential candidates of both parties every 4 years. These men and occasional women try to appeal to Iowa caucus voters by one-upping each other with outlandish statements designed to show their bona fides as Christian patriots who hate welfare cheats. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee is among the most biblically sophisticated of Republican candidates, and even he gives in to this unfortunate impulse. He is expected to be a front runner briefly, though few believe he'll cinch the nomination. He has a new book out called God, Guns, Grits, and Gravy, a full-throated and unapologetic conflation of what he calls Bubbaville with Christian values over against secular humanism of the folks who live in the cities on the East and West Coasts. It is interesting that the social justice Mr. Huckabee most approves of revolves around maintaining Second Amendment rights, rolling back Roe v. Wade, stopping advances in the acceptance of gay marriage, and maintaining a strong national defense because of the Muslim threat. Why is it that Huckabee's vision of Christianity fits so comfortably within the party platform of the GOP? Are we really to believe that America has a Christian political party and that Jesus is a Republican? I know I can say without fear of contradiction that Jesus isn't a spineless Democrat either. I have no doubt he would denounce the presidential platforms of both parties, but he would want his followers to use the system to advance justice whenever we can, since few of us are particularly adept at loaves and fishes level miracles. But in order to break out of the prison of complacency and spiritual apathy, we have to shed our identities as American Christians and become Christians who happen to be Americans. This means taking collective action as congregations, as well as individual Christians, to promote justice. Yes, I'm advocating that Christians truly become worthy of Glenn Beck's nightmare by doing lots of things that come at the expense of narrowly American economic and political interests. I advocate this knowing full well it will lead to the revocation of the social contract between the government and houses of worship. We would probably lose our tax-exempt status if we said the things we really needed to say, given the problems we would be compelled to address. If the church were suddenly to put the pursuit of social and political justice on the front burner as an expression of, but not the entirety of, our obedience to Christ, it would have a profoundly revolutionary effect almost immediately. Christians would lose the veneer of respectability that's killing us and that holds most of us down with velvet chains. Our desire to be considered pragmatic and reasonable enablers of the social order, whatever it happens to be, has made us irrelevant when it comes to the great issues of the day. When you think about the abolitionist movement of the 19th century, you think of individual Christians and a few maverick congregations, but most American Christians accepted the status quo of slavery as God ordained because those in power dictated their message. It would not have taken a civil war to end American slavery if every congregation had stood up against that abomination instead of enabling it by being polite. When you think of the civil rights movement, you think of the masses,
You think of the masses of idealistic individuals from every Christian denomination joining people of goodwill from other faith traditions and no faith traditions, taking it upon themselves to travel to the South to protest for voting rights. What you don't think about is how the church collectively spoke with one voice in a denunciation of American apartheid, because it didn't. There were far too many churches that bought into the fiction that equality was something God would bring about in heaven, and that for the sake of peace and order, blacks should be quiet and accept their lot in life like good Christians who know their place and accept it. Today, even Republican presidential candidates are pretending to care about wealth disparity in our society and across the planet. What is the church's stand on this issue as we stagger into the 2016 political season? Are we even starting to think about the gross disparities in wealth and poverty that allow a small group of people to own the vast majority of the world's resources? Still, because there are so many extremes in anti-Christian behavior masquerading as Christian these days, we have to ask how Jesus' revolutionary ethic became synonymous with protecting the status quo that openly oppresses the poor and the powerless. How does Jesus look, act, and talk suspiciously like Ted Nugent in this heretical theology? There's a cost to being a Christian, but few of us are willing to pay it. Everyone wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die, the great Joe Lewis said. No one even wants to be inconvenienced. Recently, Sarah Palin wrote, "God bless our troops, especially our snipers," in a Facebook post in response to the movie American Sniper. That self-described Bible-believing Christian American patriot doesn't have even a smidgen of embarrassment about extolling the actions of a man who took credit for more than 130 killings, as if it were the most Christ-like thing in the world. How do we get to the point in our Christian life that we simply fail to see the obvious, that Jesus, regardless of one's belief about why we were in Iraq in the first place, is going to have problems with someone killing tens of dozens of people, many of them women and children? An American sniper is not going to get a pass just because he saved his buddies in the theater of war. His patriotism will not save him when he stands before his God and has to give an account for every shot taken and for every act of mercy and justice on behalf of his fellow man not taken. Next week, we're going to talk about American exceptionalism, where we get more into this question. But for the time being, those are my random thoughts. So thanks. Let's open this up for discussion now. Yes, ma'am.
I wanted you to know, did you ever hear of Reverend John Galbraith?
I'm sorry.
John Galbraith, who started this church in the 50s, he actually went and marched in Selma.
Yes.
And he was remarkable in his efforts as a chaplain in World War and then... As a secular citizen type, I'm sure, in the community, and then as a pastor of our church.
Yes. In fact, I heard about that for the first time last week, and I was quite impressed by that. I think that's probably one of the reasons that Molly comes here from time to time. So she's probably aware of that, too, and just the good work you folks are doing in general. Anyone say anything? So if we can just sort of...
I think here's one over here.
Oh, okay.
I hope I'm not diverting the conversation, but It seems to me underlying all of the code words, and let's face it, capitalism is also a code word, is a dispute about who should determine the use of the resources of our country and our people. The question seems to be, should our social systems, government, local entities, whatever, our social systems, the expression of our people, should they determine how our wealth is to be used? Or are we still willing to allow those who create that wealth through business entities to continue to make those stewardship decisions? Isn't that the underlying question behind all of the code words, all of the assertions? It's who makes the decision about distributing wealth, about deciding what businesses to run and how heavily to tax them, and what is our system for allocation of the produce of our effort?
No. I think that it's in this country we do have an electorate. We have right now, maybe on a good election day, we can get 25% of the people to come out and vote. So we're not. I mean, that's an illusion that that we have a participatory democracy where we get to decide, how things are done, how the wealth is spent. Right now, it's effectively an oligarchy. And so what I'm concerned about is how we as the church respond to the conditions of oligarchy. And that will determine whether we're worth the damn, really. Because if we just sit around and accept the status quo, we're not worth anything. We're salt that has lost its saltiness. We're neither hot nor cold, and Jesus is going to spit us out of his mouth, and that we mean nothing to anyone. And so I understand that that's how it's often framed, that it's, the wealth creators and anyone who's created wealth has a right to determine the use of the resources. But I don't know. I kind of doubt that the 1% of the 1% who are going to own, over 50% of everything, by the end of next year, have really worked for that. Most of the folks who are in that position inherited their wealth. A lot of them are idiots and haven't worked a day in their life. It's like Conrad Hilton was on the plane recently. We read about in the paper last week, Paris Hilton's younger brother, and he was cursing out the flight attendants and the stewardesses and so forth, and he was drunk and agitated, and they asked him to sit down, Mr. Hilton, sit down. And he said, no, I own all of you. Everyone on this plane, I can buy you all 300 times and more. I own you. And when he passed out, they finally slipped some cuffs on him. But here was a guy, because of his wealth, presumed that he had all the privilege in the world, because that's how he's treated, as someone who owns it all. And we have to stand up against that. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Just wanting to respond partly to what you were saying and partly to what Doug is saying. I'm in the middle of a book by Jeffrey Sachs called The Price of Civilization. And in this book, it talks about how we live together as a community of people. And one of the points he makes is that the heart of the people is not really, what we really believe is not how we're really living. The American people really believe that we should care for our our less well-off brothers and sisters, but somehow, because of the way financing has overtaken the elections, that never comes out. It's never expressed in what we actually do.
Right.
But the values of the American people are still alive and well, and we do believe that we're our brother's keeper. We just haven't learned how to do it in the political sense.
And that's where we, as a re-energized church, American church, that does believe in these things. You know, I believe the American church has done more good than harm. I honestly believe that. But in what it hasn't done, in the justice it hasn't, chased, has resulted in our current state of affairs. The fact is that no one is energized to do anything. And I would think that the church would be the place, or should be the place, that prophetically challenges the American people to do the right thing. And right now, you have everyone, not everyone, but certainly politically, you can't run for office without saying that you're a Christian. And that the majority of Americans still say and believe that this is a Christian nation, whatever that means. Where is the saltiness? Where is the fire? Where is the antagonism towards the system? Why is the system comfortable? Why are people comfortable by saying we're a Christian nation as if that wasn't somehow, that should be a non sequitur? I mean, Christians are not nationalists or shouldn't be. You know, would Jesus say, hey, you know, I'm a Palestinian, forget all of those people over there or, you know, or in that country? No. Yes.
I don't think there's anyone here who argues the need for social justice, but how do you think we can achieve it?
I think, first of all, there has to be a period. It's like Martin Luther King said in his letter to Birmingham, from Birmingham jail. He said that the civil rights movement, in order to be relevant, there has to be a counting of the cost at the beginning. There has to be a real sit down, a come to Jesus moment with the people who were involved in a protest. They have to understand what they're doing and who they're serving. And then he said there has to be a period of purification where people go through training, discussions, Bible study, and so forth, and truly understand so that when they go out there and march down Main Street in Birmingham, and the dogs are coming at them, and the fire hoses are coming at them, they're not going to run away, and that they're going to suffer because they know that there's something higher than their own personal condition. And I think that the church really has to have that conversation. Like, we don't understand that there's a cost to be paid for being a Christian. We admire Christians in China, because they were persecuted, and Christians in the old Soviet Union, and the Christians in Islamic countries right now who have to worship underground. We admire that. And we understand intellectually that there's a price to be paid for those folks being Christians. But here, we get upset. I mean, literally upset if anyone says anything even remotely derogatory about Christians in the media. Fox News, I hate to keep using them as a boogeyman, but they have, beginning in September, October, they have their whole War on Christmas campaign going, in which they try to agitate people into believing that there's a war against Christianity in America, and that, if those Satanists win, it's all over. And it's just nonsense over and over. We just worry about the wrong things instead of worrying about the right things or getting excited about the things that truly matter. So I think it takes a long period of introspection. And then churches are going to have their different rates of enlightenment, as it were. But I think that an honest discussion is going to lead to action sooner than later. And it doesn't necessarily have to be coordinated. You just need to have churches acting like churches. and willing to step out. It's like a church in the Southwest that decides that it's going to help illegal immigrants, because what would Jesus have done given that situation? You know, and it doesn't, and I don't want anyone to think that I'm somehow just advocating the left-wing actions. I believe that, you know, the fight for life, you know, that begins in the womb, you know, is equally valid. I believe that the whole left-right continuum is in many ways nonsensical. Whatever you're going to do, it's going to make the system uncomfortable if you're really doing it in the name of Christ. And I think that's what every church really should be concerned about right now. Is it making the world comfortable, making Americans comfortable, or is it challenging Americans? And if it isn't challenging Americans, you know, I know at my church we have this discussion all the time. We're, you know, all the time. Are we there to be salt, or are we there to just be, you know, a doormat? And you just have to have it.
You said last week you would tell us this week who the modern day prophets are.
Well, I named Molly. Who do any of you guys know Molly? A few hands here. I mean, locally, I think Molly Rush. There are a whole bunch of like local people who are just doing outstanding work with the poor. There's prophets, Big P, people who are like getting hauled off to jail and so forth, and prophets, Little P, who are just doing what the majority of churches do, is you know, helping the poor, going out, going out at night, you know, in freezing weather and delivering sandwiches and helping people find shelter and so forth and so on. All of those things count too. But there isn't anyone like, I think, on a national level who I would say was like King was at his height. I think the church is much too diminished and fragmented now. The one thing about segregation, it was able to produce great leaders in a concentrated area, but I think now it's hard to find that great Christian leader. Oh, you know, yeah, he's not American, but yes, yeah, definitely.
It seems to me that white people can't even see racism. They can't even see it.
I hope they can.
Well, it's hard. It's hard. No, I shouldn't say that. I say it's hard for them to see it. But black people, it's very plain. They see it very well. I mean, I know the legal system really well, and the system is racist, but a lot of white people in it can't see that. So here's my question. Looking at the leaders in the world, in Europe and Russia, China, America, do you think that there's any change in their ability to see racism?
And, the leaders?
And in their ability to see inequality and to appreciate it. I'll give an example. On Fox News, which I'm not a fan of, but there were two very interesting things that happened. Megyn Kelly, who's a very conservative, called out Karl Rove and Dick Cheney on Fox News.
I was impressed.
So she's a conservative, and she called them out on how wrong they have been.
Yeah.
And so the question is, on the upper levels of leadership in the world, do you think that there has been some increased ability to see these problems and to want to address them?
I don't know. I have no idea. I know in this country, because I hesitate to talk about. I mean, I'm, despite, you know, 4 years of French, I still don't speak it. You know, I had my ability to sort of assess world leaders, you know, fairly is limited. It's just what I read in papers, but. I think that in this country, our leaders are
are a reflection of us, and they're woefully inept. And when it comes to racism in particular, you know, for me, I'm not even hung up about racism so much as I'm hung up about economic disparity, because I think that I'm better off personally, and my kids are better off personally than most white people financially speaking. You know, I think many blacks have been given opportunities that were undreamed of a generation ago. You know, having said that, I think that there is a wholesale disregard for the poor and the oppressed. And I think that the white working class has been sold a bill of goods, that they've been co-opted and tricked into supporting policies and actions that are against their interests, and that this would be like a natural constituency for the church to reach out to these, you know, hurting brothers and sisters and say there's a different vision of how you can live, and that you don't have to live a humiliated existence or look down on, you know, Hispanics or, you know, blacks or anyone else. You know, you just have to, you know, you have to get access to the system just like everyone else, and that, you know, you have an ally in the church. I think that the working class whites probably are equally disadvantaged as blacks and Hispanics, though they don't think so. And I think that that's a crippling illusion. I know lots of working class white folks who go to my church who can barely put two sentences together, who still think that they're better off. If they had a chance to trade places with me, let's say, in my bank account, they wouldn't, because I'm black. That's, like, ridiculous. Chris Rock has this joke about how he asked his chauffeur once whether he would ever trade places with him. Chris Rock is the comedian worth about $50 million. And his chauffeur said, no, sir. His white chauffeur, no, sir. I can make it, too. I'm convinced that you know, you worked hard for your thing, and you know, God bless you, but being black would be a disadvantage. It's like, really? Really? Okay.
We have time for one more question. Nobody?
Nobody? All those hands that were up before.
I can't believe. No.
It's funny. I hope that I don't come across as someone who believes in, you know, the wholesale redistribution of wealth. I think, you know, closing tax loopholes, just being fair, you know, taxing income that's made in America instead of allowing it to go overseas. I think having a Congress that isn't bought and paid for, you know, by wealthy interests. I think any number of normal things might bring about at least an approximation of fairness. I think that there was a period, the post-war period, you know, from 1945 to about 1980, when people shared in, you know, the economic benefits of America. You didn't have like these gross ratios of CEOs making 400 times what their lowest paid, you know, employee makes. You just didn't see that. And things have changed in the last, you know, 40 years, you know, 35 to 40 years. And I would like to see maybe a fair, fair taxation across the board. I'm not saying a flat tax or anything. I think that rich people should be taxed and not indulge in their desire not to pay taxes. But, you know, I think if you work hard and you have an idea and it makes money, God bless you. But you're not entitled to making all the money at the rest of our expense. So.
Thank you.